מעילי הפשוט ופנס על הגשר, ליל הסתיו ושפתי הלכות מניגשר. כך ראית אותי ראשונה התזכור, והיה לי ברור כמו שתיים ושתיים, כי אהיה בשבילך כמו לחם ומים, אל מים ולחם אליי תחזור. בעוניינו אמר בעבור אותך זעם, גם למוות אתה קיללתני לא פעם, וכתפיי הקרות רעדו משמחה, כי היה לי ברור כמו שתיים ושתיים שיובילו בגללי בנחושתיים, וגם אז לבבי לא יסור מעמך. כן היה זה לא טוב, היה רע לדברת, אבל זכור איך נפגשנו בליל מלילות. אם יהיה זה שנית, אל יהיה זה אחרת, רק אותה בנייה וסוררת, באותו צברת, באותה שמלה פשוטה משמלות. אם יהיה זה שנית, אל יהיה זה אחרת, יהיה כך, כך יהיה עוד מאוד. וקינאתי לך ובחושך ערבתי, ושנאתי לך ואתם אהבתי, וביתנו שמע מחיוך ומצחוק, ובשובך אל הבית מרות כמו כלב, אלבונות של זרים בנקמת פי אלף, ואדע כי חשבת עליי מרחוק. ובלילה הוא את היתחת בדלת, והלכת לאט ואני נושאת ילד. רק חשך אור עיניי אך ליבי לא נשבר, כי היה לי ברור כמו שתיים ושתיים שתשוב עד אליי וטיפול על ברכיים, ואני בפניך ביט ואומר. כן היה זה לא טוב, היה רע לדברת, אבל טוב שנפגשנו בליל מלילות. אם יהיה זה שנית, אל יהיה זה אחרת, רק אותה בנייה וסוררת, באותו מילון עם אותו ציץ הבן, באותה שמלה הפשוטה משמלות. אם יהיה זה שנית, אל יהיה זה אחרת, יהיה כך, כך יהיה עוד מאוד.
Ja, hallo, hier ist Felice Herrschaft und im Studio begrüße ich sehr herzlich Soha Shavit. Sie ist Professorin an der Tel Aviv Universität für Kulturforschung mit dem Spezialgebiet, könnte man sagen, die Kultur der Kinder, aber auch der deutschen und jüdischen Kinderliteratur. Und heute in der Sendung wollen wir auch über eine Forschung sprechen, die schon über einen sehr langen Zeitraum besteht, die jetzt auch veröffentlicht wurde letztes Jahr, und zwar Past Without Shadow ist ein Buch, das im Routledge Verlag erschienen ist, Past Without Shadow, und in diesem Bereich geht es dann darum, die verschwiegene Geschichte oder was die Deutschen ihren Kindern über den Holocaust erzählen, ist dort ein Bereich, in dem Sie arbeiten. Jetzt haben wir gerade ein Stück gehört. Vielleicht können Sie sagen, was wir gerade, welche Musik wir gerade gehört haben.
Okay, I'll speak English, perhaps with some German words, because I don't trust my German grammar. This poem was written by Alexander Penn, and the music was composed by Sasha Argov. The interesting thing about this poem, besides it being a very nice poem, that was that the poet Alexander Penn was a very known personality during the 30s and the 40s. He was known in the small Jewish community at that time as a communist poet, which meant almost automatically that he was considered outside the legitimate borders of the new emerging Hebrew literature. He was also very handsome and very well-known Don Juan. And he wrote this poem to the best-known actress who was playing in Habima. Both of them were cultural heroes. And this is one of the most beautiful love poems that I know, because it tells about a lost love, a love that has no chances. Its main line reads, we had a wonderfully bad time. Wunderbar schreckliche Zeit, oder wunderbar schreckliche Liebe hatten wir. And if it were to repeat itself, I would have done the same thing. And the whole poem tells about a love that was realized. They had one daughter, but could never really go on. They had several beautiful, very painful days, and this poem is all about. Now, the interesting thing about this poem and the other poems that we'll be listening to during the program is that several poems were written by our best known poets, poets that are so well known and canonized that they now also known because they have their street names after them. So like here, if you walk between Goethe and Schiller streets in Tel Aviv, you can walk between Shlonsky and Alterman and Penn streets. And the poems were written by the modernist group of writers who wrote poems that were not very easy to understand. The metaphors, the figures are very difficult to follow. And what made them very known and popular among Israeli society is that the fact that they became part of the, not pop music, but of songs that you can hear over the radio and over CDs. And it's very interesting that they were adopted by some of our best singers and became part of the public sphere, so to speak, because they were made into songs. But when you listen carefully to the words, sometimes you're not sure you can really follow them.
Mm. Ja, vielen Dank für diese
Einführung in die israelische Literatur. Kurz.
Ja, und könnten Sie erzählen, bevor wir auf das Thema der verschwiegenen Geschichte oder auch der Ersetzung eines bestimmten Narrativs kommen, indem wir jetzt in Deutschland die Geschichte des Holocaust erzählt wird. Wie ist Ihre Familie nach Israel gekommen?
Well, like any other story, it's a rather complicated story. My parents came from Europe long before the Holocaust. And this is very important because, as I will probably refer to it later, I was not grown up as a Holocaust kid, as many families in Israel have been. My father came already in 1924 to Israel from Yalta. He came from a very wealthy family, well-to-do family, assimilated family. They were assimilated to such a degree that he didn't even know Yiddish. When you grow up in an Israeli family coming from Europe, Eastern Europe, without knowing any Yiddish, it means that your family had very little to do with the Jewish tradition. He knew French, German. He had two Kindermädchen, one for his French, one for his German. He went to the gymnasium, so he was among those who were, despite the numerous clauses, managed to go into high school. And then he was even accepted to the university. And then something very wrong happened to him. He became a Zionist, which for his family immediately turned him into the black sheep, because like all his family, he was meant to commerce and, you know, to develop the family business. And as a matter of fact, their house still stands in Yalta and is considered heritage monument because it was built by one of the best-known architects. It so happened also that Marshak, Samuel Marshak, was my grand-uncle. and they all lived in the same house, which actually it's a big villa in Yalta. So he came to Israel, to Eretz Israel, Palestine at the time, at a very early stage, out of ideological reasons. And my mother came a little bit later, and then they met and got married. Also, she came from a well-to-do family, not so wealthy, and that did have even strong linkage to the Jewish tradition. His family was all destructed on the same day. I mean, this is something that I learned about very late. When the Nazi came to Yalta at 41, there were very few Jews who were allowed to settle in Yalta. You had to pay, I think, a lot for this permission. And they were it was very easy to find a family, and they didn't even bother too much with them. They simply hanged them, according to the archive. So he lost all his family all at once. And all I can remember from my childhood is that he was listening to the radio. We had the radio program which was called Find Your Relatives. And then people would, on the radio, look for the relatives. I was born there and there. I'm this and this old. Do you know if any of my relatives survived? So that's my only memory that is somehow linked to the Holocaust. My father listened to those radio program, and eventually he found some very... really a relative that were not really part of the family, but he was so much eager to find some family that he brought them to Israel, and they were even less Jewish than he was, so this belongs to another history. My mother's side, they had actually better fate because perhaps they were not assimilated to such an extent. So most of her family managed to escape. They were a Jewish, typical Jewish family. One of them was left-wing, one was communist, one was Zionist, and one was right-wing. So the right-wing was to Buenos Aires. The communists decided to stay in Poland. My mother, the Zionist, came to Israel, and her brother, the communist, was on the way to Treblinka. He jumped from the train with his son and managed to join the partisans, but then they were found and they were executed. So her family, the history of her family in terms of the Holocaust was less catastrophic. But interestingly enough, at home there wasn't much discussion of it. We were the new Zionists, the new Israelis. We came to build a new country, a new nation. We don't really want to have anything to do with our past, which we are not very proud of. And this was the kind of education where I grew. I grew in a Holocaust Reihenhaus, so to speak. It wasn't a theme to discuss at home. Though, of course, it was somehow present in the background of the... not even in everyday life, but somehow in the bracket. By contrast, in my school, my teacher was a member of the Widerstand in the Kovno ghetto. And about that, Vilna ghetto. We used to hear all... I mean, the only thing I remember from this teacher and from her classes were stories about her... history about her own past as a young partisan, and probably it did influence me somewhere. I mean, not at that time I knew about it, but it was in the background. But I would like to emphasize again that I'm very untypical Israeli child, in the sense that my house was, I grew up in an atheist house, ideologically motivated. My parents were very much involved in Israeli political matters, and I remember very strong political arguments because they didn't vote the same party. They were both leftists, but my mother was not a communist, but it was a version of a party that supported communism but was a Zionist. And I remember that even in late 50s, I was born 51. So when I still remember when I was 8 years old, first of all, we took part in the 1st of May parade. We would put the red flag at our home. And my mother, when she would take a nap during daytime, she would say, even if Stalin comes, don't wake me up. Which was, you know, the ultimate, this is God Almighty, Stalin. Afterwards, of course, you know, like everyone have party, they would resent Stalinism. But at that time, I can still remember this race. This means that when I first came to Germany to do a research on the Haskalah, the Jewish Enlightenment, I came as someone who has no feeling whatsoever for the Jewish-German past. I mean, I said, okay, we open a new page. We start from Nullstunde, okay, 45 onward. I was interested in the golden days of Jewish intellectuals in Germany, beginning the 18th century until the middle of the 19th century. And it was my stay in Germany that really changed me dramatically.
In welcher Weise?
First of all, I realized that I'm very sensitive to many things that I would have never thought that I'd be sensitive to. For instance, it was very difficult for me to meet people. I came here for the first time in the 80s, 84. Actually, I came a little bit earlier because I got a prize for a translation of a book into Hebrew, and I was given the prize in Würzburg. This was my first time I came to Germany. And I remember that in the 80s, whenever I saw someone who was in his 50s, 60s, I couldn't help asking myself, was he or was he not? I couldn't remain, indifferent to people who might have taken part, might have participated. At that time, I didn't know the big difference between passive and active, which is very popular in the German narrative, but I was very sensitive to that. I was terribly sensitive to Achtung calls in the train station, for instance. It made me freeze, you know. Achtung, Achtung, the train. I was very sensitive to train stations to begin with. Very. But, you know, it was all sort of back in my mind, and I was never aware of it until I came here. And then when I came to do this research, we came to stay in Bad Godesberg. I wouldn't send my children to German school, so this was already a first sign that something different happens here. Because when we went on sabbatical to Chicago, I had no problem whatsoever to send the children to an American school. But here I said, well, now I can sort of rationalize it, but at that time I said, no, this is too much. They go to a British school, which was, by the way, a very expensive decision because these were private schools. And when I began to do my research as sort of a moonlighting job, I was also lectoring by Israeli publishing house. And I made it a decision to close the gap of translating German children's literature into Hebrew. Because for a long time, we didn't translate books from German at all. And then there was still sort of taboo on translating German children's literature into Hebrew. The last one to be translated was Erich Kästner. And then classical like Nösslinger, which for me, I don't see much difference between the Österreich and the German, Deutsche narrative. So James Chris and many other writers had not been translated. And as I was working, I had the Humboldt Fellowship, and I was with Professor Theodor Brüggemann in Köln. I began to ask my colleagues about the what kind of books they sort of recommend for me. And they began to recommend books for me that should be translated into Hebrew. And I began to read them. One of them was Damas war es Friedrich by Hans Richter. And several of these books that were considered by my colleagues as books worthwhile of being translated. And after having read, it was already in my second year in Germany, having read about dozens of them, I remember very well, I made friends with Hans-Heino Evers, who at that time was still in Bonn, but now is the director of the Institute for Jugendbuchforschung in Frankfurt. And somehow jokingly, I asked him, tell me, where are the three Germans that voted for the NS party? And he said, what? I said, where are the three Germans that participated in the genocide of the Jewish people, or the Roma for that matter? And he said, what again? And I told him, listen, when I read the books you all were so kind to recommend to me, I find a very different story from the one that I know. It is not at all similar to the narrative I grew on. With, you know, this teacher, and then, of course, Israeli texts on the Holocaust and the whole narrative, which is very present in our life. And Hans-Heino said, listen, why don't we organize a tagung on it? And I said, yeah, why not? I remember it very well because it was the first time that I dared to give a talk in German. And I exercised quite extensively to make it eligible. And we had a conference in Schwerter with Malte Dahrendorf. And I sort of presented for the first time my analysis of Damas Varis Friedrich. And I'll never forget the reaction. The audience that came to listen to me was consisted, of course, of good-willing Germans. I mean, Germans who care, Germans who resist the attempts to forget about the past, Germans who are conscious socially and politically, but the room almost froze, and they were shocked. I was shocked from the reaction because to me it was so clear what took place there. Mm-hmm. And then they began the questions and a sort of legitimizations and explanations, and sometimes people even felt a little bit hurt by this description. Luckily enough, because Ornung Muzayn, we had dinner at 8 o'clock, and otherwise we would probably continued until midnight. And then Malte Dahrendorf suggested that we publish a small book about it together, where we reacted to my talk, was rather critical about it, and we published it. And that was the first reaction to my study, where people said that I cannot make these generalizations, and what I do is really, in a way, justice. I mean, it's true for the books I've analyzed, but I have analyzed only 14 books, and there are many more books that I have not seen. And I came back to Israel, the sabbatical was over, and I decided not to deal anymore with this question because it was very hard. It was schmerzvoll. And I began to be involved in my research with, these are two things that should not happen to you when you're doing a research. You should not be involved in your research, and it shouldn't in any way relate to you emotionally. So I came back to my Haskalah, and at that time I was also doing a comprehensive study of the construction of the Israeli center in Palestine, Hebrew center, and the function of culture in the creation of a new nation, etc., etc. But it was all there, you know, in a way, it was on my desk, and actually it was here, my stomach. And I remember at the beginning of the 90s, there was a wave of anti-Semitic acts in Germany, and cemeteries were attacked, and synagogues, etc., etc. And Mr. Mon from the Bertelsmann Foundation came to our university, and he was looking for a project that will deal with the anti-Semitism. And as we'll see very soon, it was already clear to me that the texts for children, unwillingly and certainly unconsciously, have a very strong anti-Semitic component in the texts. So we met, and he he was willing to support my research, which I believe he later on, in a way, regretted, because I think that at that time people didn't realize that children's literature is the most political literature. People usually tend to believe that because it is children, it must be very naive or simple or not hurting or not involved. It's something beautiful, angel-like. It's just the opposite. I mean, I think that there is nothing as political as books for children. And with the help of the Bertelsmann and support of the Bertelsmann Foundation, we began a large-scale research. In this research, in the framework of this research, we read 347 books. Also, 347 Bücher, das ist ganz wichtig zu betonen.
Yeah.
Also meine Meinung nach haben sie alle Bücher, fast alle Bücher gelesen, die in Deutschland veröffentlicht waren.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny when I come to the German, when I speak about this group. We are a group of researchers. And we had also some German students, just to make sure that we don't only bring the Israeli point of view when we analyze the text.
Hmm.
And then I've published the results of this research, and they were not different from my original one, though I did find some texts that can point to the existence of an alternative narrative in the German children's literature. I mean, when we've seen the whole picture, we could have seen that among these 347 books, there were several books that offered an alternative narrative. It makes about four of them. So it's 1%. You can point to Gudrun Pausenwag, Reise im August, Reise im August, by Gudrun Pausenwag, which proposes a very different narrative in everything that regards the Deutsche narrative. And a book that was translated, Asher Pinkov, Kinderstern, which was translated from the Dutch into German and even got the German Jugendbuchpreis in 61.
Mm-hmm.
And there are two other short stories. So it doesn't make very many of an alternative narrative, but it shows that if German writers choose to do it, there is the possibility to offer an alternative discourse or alternative narrative, which means that their decision to stick to one narrative and not present the other one is not decision which is made out of one-way street, that they have no choice, but it is a decision that is made out of a choice, and a very clear choice. And the choice, to my mind, is the choice to stick to the consensus, to the story that the Germans prefer to tell themselves, and to be part of the consensus. And I even remember that at one point in one of the meetings I had with readers and some editors, one editor told me, listen, it is not that I don't want to publish alternative texts. It is that if I dare to publish the alternative texts, the parents would not even buy the other texts that I publish. In a way, this will contaminate them. It will make me be seen as someone who is not in the framework of the consensus. And that's why I'll never publish a book which is outside the consensus. And again, Gudrun Pausenwag is a very interesting exception to the rule, and very brave one.
Dann würde ich sagen, spielen wir jetzt ein weiteres Stück und dann sprechen wir über das Narrativ. Bis gleich.
לא יכלו להשתיק אותה
Ja, im Studio zurück, Soha Shavit. Das war jetzt ein Stück über einen Selbstmord?
Ja, it was written by Tirza Attar, who is the daughter of Nathan Alterman, again one of our best known poets. We'll hear later, I think, a song by him. And she was a poet herself. Her father was very concerned about her. And actually, we'll hear later a song that he wrote to her where he called her to take care of herself. And this poem was written several days before she committed suicide. And she says, well, they all know that it's already gone. The flowers in the valley, the beautiful view, the books in her room, beautiful sunshine, the beautiful sky, everything is very beautiful, but it is no more there for her, and they all know it. They know as it's shone for by. And it's a very, very sad song. Whenever I hear it, I get shiver, you know. It's beautifully sung. Again, the music was composed by Moshe Vilensky, one of our best compositors, and it's a very touching a poem, because what it says actually is that when a person is in himself is lost, nothing else can change it. The world can be as beautiful as you wish. If it's not his world, which is so beautiful and so attractive, it will not help. And the beautiful world knows that for her, for this poetess, this is all gone. It's lost. Nothing will really call her to come back to life.
Yeah.
And it's ballad for women, that's how it is called.
Ballad.
Ballad for, yeah.
Okay.
So, also, Selbstmord.
Ja, dann wenden wir
Selbstmord,
uns jetzt dem Schatten zu, dem Schatten, der auf unserer ganzen Welt liegt, wie es auch Arno Lustiger nennt.
The linkage, the direct linkage, before we go to the description of the keys of the Deutsche, of the German memory, perhaps I should say a word about Jews committing suicide. I think I've chosen this poem probably unconsciously, but actually, one of the most astonishing facts about the German narrative for children is that to begin with, Jews hardly die in the books. I mean, this is, sounds terrible, as if I were looking for where to find the dead Jews. But one of the best known facts is that millions of Jews were murdered during the Second World War and as a result of the Holocaust. And when you read the books, the Jews, they don't die. They either disappear, sie verschwinden, keiner weiß wohin, okay? Or they are taken somewhere, but the book will never tell you what happened to them. There is one book, Himmel ohne Stern by Ossofsky, where Kimmich, who is someone who is opposer of the government, he says that he heard that 8,000 Jews were murdered in Konzentrationslager. And this is the only place in books for children where you really know the Jews were systematically killed by the Germans. But, after all, Jews must die, right? I mean, even if you build a narrative that is very, very far remoted from the real facts, and there are always real facts, however postmodernist we are, I mean, there are some hard facts in every story. So the German writers have to deal with these hard facts, and there are two very interesting solutions. One very beloved solution is to put the responsibilities on the allies. So in Damas Varis Friedrich, for instance, Friedrich the Jew, he dies, but it is not result of a German act, but of the bombs by the Americans, right, or the Allies. The other very interesting strategy is to make the Jews responsible for their own fate. And among this strategy, many Jews commit suicide. Now, it is true that many Jews committed suicide, I mean, relatively many Jews, or quite few Jews, committed suicide during the Third Reich when they understood that their whole life came to an end. They who saw themselves as good Germans had no future in Germany and they didn't want to go elsewhere. But among the 6 million Jews, it was really a minority. But according to the books, you meet it time and again Jews who commit suicide. So this song is not to speak for the German narrative. I mean, I don't think the Jews tend to commit suicide more than any other nation, especially not even during the Third Reich.
Woher das gerade kam, weiß ich auch nicht. Auf jeden Fall, dann werde ich jetzt diesen Narrativ vorstellen. Sie sagen ja auch, wenden wir uns zuerst der Geschichte vom Dritten Reich und vom Holocaust zu, der die Kinder in der Bundesrepublik Deutschland mit größter Wahrscheinlichkeit begegnen. Ich nenne sie die Story. Sie lässt sich so zusammenfassen. Es gab einen schrecklichen Krieg. Hitler und eine kleine Gruppe von Nazis, die ihm hörig waren, schafften es, über ganz Deutschland zu herrschen und Krieg über das Land zu bringen. Diese Gruppe von Nazis, die sich von anderen Deutschen insofern abhob, als dass diese keine Nazis waren, war zusammen mit Hitler für den Krieg verantwortlich, den in Wirklichkeit kein Deutscher wollte. Die Mehrheit der Deutschen leistete gegen ihn und gegen Hitler Widerstand. Der Krieg verursachte schreckliches Leid, Hunger, Zerstörung ganzer Städte, das Auseinanderreißen von Familien, Vertreibung und Tod. Die Hauptleidtragenden waren die Deutschen. Ja, auch die Juden in Deutschland haben gelitten und wurden von den Nazis verfolgt, manchmal verhaftet und in einigen sehr seltenen Fällen sogar in Konzentrationslager verschickt und getötet. Doch die Juden litten nicht aufgrund der Feindseligkeit der Deutschen, denn diese mochten die Juden und beteiligten sich kollektiv an den Bemühungen, sie vor dem bösen Hitler zu retten. Die Juden litten durch die Invasion anderer Mächte, der Nazis nämlich, die ganz unerwartet und plötzlich über Deutschland herfielen und dies trotz der ununterbrochenen Anstrengungen der Deutschen, sich vor ihnen zu schützen. Nachdem Hitler seine bösen Taten in Deutschland vollbracht hatte, verschwand er aus dem Blickfeld und der Albtraum nahm sein Ende. Nun konnten die Deutschen zu den Tagen vor 1933 zurückkehren, doch für die bösen Machenschaften Hitlers wurden sie nun von den Alliierten bestraft. Diese waren sehr hart. Ihr Vorgehen gegen die Deutschen war zuweilen von einer sinnlosen Grausamkeit geprägt. So bombardierten sie 3 Jahre lang wahl- und grundlos deutsche Städte und richteten sinnlose Zerstörung an. Danach teilten sie Deutschland und verursachten auf diese Weise die Trennung von Familien, Not und Elend. Das ist eben dann das Narrativ, das in dem Sinne eine neue Geschichte in die deutsche Kinder- und Jugendliteratur bringt. Und ganz exemplarisch kann man das eben sehen an dem Bilderbuch Die Lisa von Cordon. Und dieser Klaus Cordon konstruiert die Geschichte eben um eine allegorische Hauptfigur Lisa herum, deren Gefühle, Einstellungen und menschliche Bedürfnisse eben auch nicht geschildert werden. Sie wohnt in dem Haus Nummer 10, ist dort zur Welt gekommen. Und das war in der Epoche Wilhelm II. Und überstand den Krieg. Und dieses Haus dient dann auch in der Nachkriegszeit als Schauplatz für den Wiederaufbau. Die soziale Rollenverteilung im Haus ist klar. Lisa, eine gute Deutsche, die in ihrem langen Leben viele leidvolle Erfahrungen machen musste. Hans, ein guter Deutscher, der der aggressiven Politik des Kaisers zum Opfer fiel. Else, eine Jüdin, deren Eltern Deutschland gerade noch rechtzeitig verließen, während sie selbst in Deutschland blieb und dort starb. Und Karl Jäger, ein späterer Nazi. Nach Kriegsende wird versucht, das Haus Nummer 10 wieder in die deutsche Normalität zurückzuführen. Lisa, deren Ehemann Werner im Krieg gefallen war, zieht mit Paul, dem ehemaligen Freund der Jüdin Else, zusammen. Lisa und Paul sind Schneider von Beruf und in dem entsprechenden Bild machen sie einen ziemlich glücklichen Eindruck. Aber dann kommt die Stunde der Abrechnung für die Verbrechen der deutschen Führung und Deutschland wird durch die Sieger geteilt. Auf die Willkür der Teilung wird dadurch hingewiesen, dass die Grenze zwischen West- und Ostberlin in der Mitte der Straße, in der Lisa und Paul leben, unmittelbar neben dem Haus Nummer 10 verläuft. Die DDR wird dann eben in düsteren Farben gezeichnet und im Grunde wird das als Strafe für den Krieg dargestellt. Eine persönliche Episode hebt den düsteren Charakter von Ostberlin noch zusätzlich hervor. Lisas Sohn Wolfgang zieht es aus ideologischen Gründen vor, sich in Ostdeutschland niederzulassen und bezahlt dafür einen hohen Preis. Die Ideologie treibt einen Keil zwischen Wolfgang und Klaus. Lisas anderer Sohn, der sich nach dem Mauerbau und dem Verbot Ostberlins zu besuchen, dann noch verschärft. Das ist dann eben eine Stelle, wo eben ideologische Diskussionen und politisches Engagement von Deutschen erwähnt werden. Cordon versucht eben die Zeit vor dem Ausbruch des Krieges als ideologiefrei darzustellen und schildert die Erzählung eben des ideologischen Engagements der Deutschen, das in der Familie infolge der Teilung Deutschlands dann entsteht. Die ideologiefreien Deutschen, Vorkriegsdeutschen, werden, wenn es die DDR betrifft, plötzlich ideologisch motiviert. Aber dass es dazwischen eine Zeit gab, wo sie auch ideologisch motiviert waren, das wird dabei ausgespart. Genau. Und was bedeutet das, wenn es dieses Narrativ gibt in der deutschen Kinderliteratur, dann auch für die Generation, die aufwächst, ohne Zeitzeugen, ohne tatsächlich noch einen Bezug zu einer Geschichte zu haben, die erlebt wurde?
I think that what the German children's literature does, and actually other narratives, because it's true also for films and for literature for adults, as many studies have shown, they've built a narrative with which it's much easier to live. And this narrative is constructed upon various keys. I call them keys of memory. The most important, there are two most important components to this narrative. One is that the Germans were the main victims of the Second World War, the Third Reich, and after-war time. And this is the victimization of the Germans. Nowadays, it's even popular to make a victimization of the Nazis, as the film The Untergang very clearly shows. You know, we all feel pity for the children and Goering, and even for Hitler, you know, such nice people. How could it be done to them? And so the first thing is to present the Germans as victims, and not only as victims, but as the sole victims of the Third Reich. Now, in order to build the Germans as victims, and then to have a narrative which tells, what do you want from us? We were the victims more than you were, or as much as you were. There was something else that needed to be done. The German narrative had to create an opposition between the Nazis and the Germans. The Germans were not Nazis, and the Nazis were not Germans. The Nazis were a small group of people who adored Hitler. They looked very different from the Germans, where the Germans are blonde and tall and good-looking. The Nazis are small and black, as Hitler really was. There are two groups of people, and actually the Germans got up one morning and they found out that the Nazis fell over them and they enslaved them. And after 12 years, they disappeared and Germany went back to its beautiful days. Now, one of the interesting results of this construction, which is very easy because I was a German, I was not a Nazi, so I have nothing to do with it. And the most interesting thing is the creation of the pseudo-Nazis. So you have pseudo-Nazis, the group of people who look like Nazis, but actually they are good Germans. And how do we know that they are good Germans? Because they try to help the Jews. We have even in one book a case where a German officer in SS, dressed as an SS man, comes to help in the night. He comes to help a Jewish kid, a child, to leave Germany. You know, this is such absurd things. Now, of course, if you look into history, I'm absolutely sure that you will always be able to point to a certain case, a real case, which will prove that this was possible. I'm sure that we'll find among all the SS officials, we'll find one case of someone who was helping the Jews. The problem with the German narrative is that it takes the very few rare cases and makes them into an exemplary cases. This is the main, I believe, the main strategy to manipulate the historical narrative and to tell a different story. Because as we all know, most of the SS people were not really in favor of the Jews and were not helping them to get out of Germany. And as we all well know, most of the Germans at a certain point of time became members of the German Nazi party. But you can always take the example of someone who refused to join the party. Now, the other interesting result of this construction is that the Germans were not Nazis and the Nazis were not Germans. Now, what to do with the Jews? If the Nazis are the others, the Jews are always the others. The Jews have always been in the German narrative the others, either because of philosemitic or anti-Semitic claims. Even in the 18th century, the 19th century, this belongs to another research that I'm doing. The Jews were the ultimate others because they were not pure Germans. I mean, even by definition, by religion, they were different from the Germans. Now, every nation has a repertoire, we can say a stock, where it guards its attributes for the other. There are two characteristics that characterize the other. First of all, he look different from you. And secondly, you will always describe the other very stereotypically, according to stereotypes. One describes himself not stereotypically, because we acknowledge that we are very different individuals. But when you describe the others, you will always use stereotypes. Now, the interesting thing that comes out of the narrative for children, which certainly is unconscious, and I would say not intended, is that because of this structure, which is a sine qua non for the descriptions of Germans as victims, they construct an analogy between Nazis and Jews. The Jews resemble the Nazis resemble the Jews, and they resemble them in many aspects. First of all, both Nazis and Jews are described stereotypically. And the stereotypes, it's not only that all Jews, in one book, he says, all Jews look the same to me. But also because there are many mistakes concerning Jews' habits, etc. For instance, they have someone who is certainly religious because he is wearing the yarmulke, but he comes to sell on Saturday. or the book describes the traditional family and they go out and will eat non-kosher Frankfurter. Things that everyone who knows something, even little, about Jewish manners will know, that the Jew will not eat non-kosher meat outside his house. Or when the son goes on bar mitzvah, he's 14 instead of 13 years old. The other thing is that all Jews, without an exception, except for by Gudrun Pausenberg, they are all small and black. And the image of Jews as black is so strong that when I came to Germany with my three blonde children, and we happen also to have blue eyes, people would say, aber sie sind keine Deutsche. Entschuldigung, sie sind doch eine Deutsche oder sie sind keine Jude. And then I would say, no, I am Jewish, I'm small. This must be confessed, but I'm blonde. And they would say, but they would get a little bit confused. And they said, but you don't look like a Jew. Why don't I look like a Jew? Because the color of my hair. And this still happens to me. People would say, aber sie sind keine Jude. Because you're not wearing the right colors. Now, yes. As a result of this analogy, the sort of message we get is that at first the Jews were manipulating the Germans and using them and taking advantage of them because they were richer, they were cleverer. That's where I would say that the philo-Semitic turns into anti-Semitic feelings. And then came the Nazis who were doing the same thing to the Germans. So actually the Nazis were replacing the Germans and the poor Germans always remained the victims. And if you want to see how strong this is in the German narrative, I would like to read two citations from one of the most popular German books, which is called Damals war es Friedrich. This was the most popular book. It was sold in millions, I believe in 6 million copies. It was translated to almost all languages, including Hebrew. And there is in one of the chapters, the Jewish child must leave the school. And then the teacher is, in a way, willing to speak on his behalf. And he says the following. Juden sind Menschen wie wir. Okay. And then he explains why people hate the German. And said, weil sie nicht glaubten, dass Jesu der wahre Messiah sein, weil sie ihn für einen Betrüger hielten, wie es derer schon andere gegeben hatte, deshalb haben sie ihn gekreuzigt. Okay, also ich dachte, dass der Pop hat uns davon gelassen. Und das haben sie ihnen viele bis heute nicht verziehen. Sie glauben die unsinnigsten Dinge, die über Juden verbreitet werden. Einige warten nur darauf, die Juden wieder verfolgen und peinigen zu können. Okay, then we have actually one repeats here the anti-Semitic case or the cause. And then when he wants to, in a way, defend the Jews, he says, so goes es weiter. Man wirft den Juden vor, sie seien verschlagen und hintersichtig. Wie sollten sie es nicht sein? So steht im Buch. Man behauptet, die Juden seien geldgierig und betrügerisch. Müssen sie es nicht sein? Sie haben erfahren, dass Geld das einzige Mittel ist, mit dem sie sich notfalls Leben und Unversehrlichkeit erkaufen können. Und das, so steht es in Damals war es Friedrich, Seite 57. And this is the book that German children grow on. Das Buch war sehr verbreitet in Schulen. Wenn ein Kind ein Buch gelesen hat, wurde es, damals war es schon gelesen. Und deshalb denke ich, dass diese Geschichte sehr verbreitet ist. I also believe that one of the things that was for me most astonishing was that so many German writers tend to tell this same narrative. Because usually writers of, you know, they're individuals, everyone wants to tell his own story, especially when they present their story as an autobiographical story. And my feeling is that German writers who write today, or wrote 10 years ago, grew on the story of Friedrich. And they adopted it as a model for reconstructed German history. And what they keep telling us is that it's not the story of their own life, of their own family, or of someone they knew. What they are telling us is a story that was once constructed in the German narrative for children, and since then serves as the model upon which history is constructed in Germany for children.
Ja, jetzt sind wir schon fast am Ende der Sendung. Wir sollten vielleicht demnächst eine Fortsetzung planen, um über noch diese weiteren Aspekte der deutschen Kinder- und Jugendliteratur zu sprechen, die dieses Narrativ tatsächlich reproduziert, dann ja auch noch heute. Und
wir wollen noch ein, haben Sie, wir wollen noch ein Zeit für noch ein...
Noch ein Zitat?
Nein, nicht Zitat, sondern ein sehr schönes...
Ein Stück, ja, ein dann Stück. Spielen wir noch das Stück.
Ja, das ist
Stück
ein sehr schönes
Liebe. Ja. Und über auch Ihre kulturelle Tätigkeit in Israel, in Tel Aviv, dann sprechen wir auch demnächst weiter.
Ja, gerne.
Ja, wunderbar, dann vielen Dank
für
das Kommen in diese Sendung. Und
ja, und Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom, ja. Ja, Mikrofon verabschieden sich Zohar Shavit und Felicia Herrschaft.
Shimri nafshech, kochech, shimri, shimri nafshech. Shimri chayayich, binatech, shimri chayayich. Mikir nofel, migag nidelak, mitzel chashech. Meeven kela, misakin, mitzipornayim. Shimri nafshech, min hasoref, min hachotech. מן הסמוך כמו אפר וכמו שמיים מן הדומר מן המחכה והמושך והממית כמי באר ואש קיריים נפשך שמרי ובינתך שיער ראשך אורך שמרי שמרי נפשך שמרי חיי Dua v'yashan Sheba l'chesed U'l'rachamim Lo l'mora V'lo l'rachash Hashadot u'dvar ashan Sheba im reyach Tavshilim V'im nora asher ta'im Adim nanuach V'nishan Adim nanuach V'nishan Rak erev kaitz ham vatov lichora Rak erev kaitz ham sheba lo lemora Hinei haruach yad sholachet uvli rachash Pitom chalon leat niftach bachashecha Imri madua at sochekit kemo pachad Imri madua at kofet kemo simcha Imri madu ha'olam kozar adayim Ve'esh v'mayim mabitim bo mikol tzad Imri madu ha'bo mefarperim chayayich Kemo tzipor